Good morning, everybody. It is September 22nd, 2021. This is the ADK Homeroom. I am your host, Frank, and welcome again to this daily homeroom. I am feeling great. Allergies from the past few days have left me alone a little bit, at least so far this early morning. The sun isn't even up here. Over the Adirondacks, gorgeous sunset last night. We had those pink cotton candy clouds last night scudding over the mountains as the sun nestled itself down over the hills. So that means, I think, that we're going to have a great show for you, of course, because red sky at night means great show before the sun rises the next morning. I think that's how it goes, right? The old adage. All right, we've got by request here, the second in a series of what your kids are learning. I've spent 25 years in the classroom, and I am sharing that with you now. Today, we are doing English, and there is good news. There is absolutely great news, in fact, in some respects with the English curriculum and what your kids are learning in English class. You see, the good news is that since the 1990s, there has been significant improvement. The bad news, I guess, is that partly that's because in the 1990s, English teaching absolutely lost its mind. They just went off the deep end in the 1990s with this thing called whole language. Now, we need to understand whole language. We need to understand what happened in the 1990s to understand what's going on in the classroom now, because we have recovered from it a lot, and I'll detail the ways in which we've recovered from it, but there are also a bunch of ways that we have not recovered from the 1990s when English teaching went off the rails, and not in that good Ozzy Osbourne crazy train kind of way. They just went off the rails, period. Oh, Ozzy. We miss Ozzy. So, I mean, we miss Ozzy being in the news. We don't miss Ozzy as in he's passed away. He has not passed away. I just miss Ozzy in the news. Now, let's look at whole language and how that has led us to our current state of English education. What happened was, in the 1990s, you had teachers say, ooh, and professors, it started, of course, in the colleges, and they taught the teachers to do this. The professor said, ooh, you know, we need to really focus on higher order thinking skills. We need to focus on the top of Bloom's taxonomy. Bloom's taxonomy, if you're not familiar with it, is this very big idea with educators. And it says that there are levels to your thinking, and that at the lower levels, you have mere knowledge, just knowing something and memorizing something. Those are at the bottom. They're on the lowest rung of this order, this hierarchy of knowledge. And they get poo-pooed. They get looked down upon by teachers, because teachers and the professors who do education classes, they will say, oh, just learning something, just knowing something, that's no big deal. A computer could do that. It could just spit back this knowledge for you. Anything that's just regurgitation is at the bottom of the thinking skills. We need to teach the higher order thinking skills. So as you go up this ladder, you get to the higher order thinking skills, which are things like evaluation and analysis and synthesis. Synthesis is huge. It's at the top of the order, and it is huge for educators because they think that, because it resonates with what they've learned in their history classes, because they hear the word synthesis, they hear dialectic, and they don't really realize that there is a big difference between Hume's dialectic and the historical historical dialectic, the dialectical materialism of Marx and Engels. They just hear the word dialectic, and that sets off resonating bells, and they have been taught that interdisciplinary skills are super important, and they're synthesizing in that way. So they are putting things together themselves. They're doing synthesis themselves, and they can give themselves a little pat on the back. Never realizing, like I said, that dialectic is in fact quite different in the sense that Hume used it and the sense that Marx and Engels used it in their dialectic materialism. So, in this Bloom's taxonomy, it meant that just mere knowledge, the lowest order, was something that we did not need to teach. The biggest way this came across was spelling. In the 1990s, if you were unfortunate enough to go through school then, or if you had a child in school then, you saw that the English teachers were not teaching kids how to spell in the elementary school. They called this whole language. Whole language meant that the kid was going to grow up and he just approached language as a whole. We did not need to break it down into parts for him. We did not need to give him spelling as a separate part, because the argument went, when did you ever see a 21-year-old who can't spell cake or night or dialectic even? Or, you know, these difficult words like sight or tough in the English language. Kids just pick that up naturally. And this was one of the parts that we didn't need to teach. There were, of course, other mere knowledge parts of the language that we didn't need to teach, like grammar. The argument went that when a child had grown up and he was 21 years old, did you ever hear a 21-year-old saying, me go to store, mommy, or just me go to store? No. Kids, the argument went in whole language, naturally learn how to put language together into a whole with a subject and a verb in a sentence, so you don't need to teach them about subjects and verbs in sentences. That is just mere knowledge. That is just knowing something. It isn't about synthesizing anything or putting anything together. A subject with a conjugated verb, nobody needs to be taught that individually. Kids just learn how to conjugate verbs. You don't need to teach how to match up a subject and verb. You don't see 21-year-olds walking around saying, I is. They know to say, I am. It's so nonsense to the idea that we need to teach that. That's what whole language said. Well, guess what? Of course, what happened, and they said the same thing for vocabulary also, you didn't need to teach vocabulary. But of course what happened is you got to high school, and about 5 years, 7 years after they had started teaching this, the kids were getting into high school and people were saying, oh boy, these kids actually don't know how to spell. It turns out you can have kids entering high school and they don't know how to put the E on the end of cake. I was teaching at the time, you had kids coming into high school spelling tough with an F. You had kids writing psi without the GH on the end. And it turns out that English is a tricky language, and the kids weren't just getting it naturally. So, to their credit, to the English teacher's credit, they junked it. And 5 years previous, if you went to an English teacher's conference and you spoke against whole language, you were ostracized. You were out of the pack. They gave you dirty looks. They wouldn't talk to you. They would sit down with you at that pressed turkey roll and vegetarian option lunch. That was it. You were out. But then 5 years later, oh, everybody realized, okay, we got to junk this. And so it was great. They did junk that with the spelling. And they even went back to teaching vocabulary a little bit too, which was great. However, they never went back to teaching grammar. They did see the issues with spelling, right? Because for one thing, it was embarrassing putting up posters in eighth grade in the hallways for parents' night with the kids not being able to spell talk and walk correctly in eighth grade. That was just embarrassing, and the parents could immediately see that. So, you know, it was one thing to do that. But grammar, that was a little bit harder for the parents to see. There are really three reasons why they never went back to teaching grammar. One is that it wasn't as obvious for the parents to see that their kids couldn't diagram a sentence, that their kids were missing out direct objects, transitive versus intransitive, diagramming sentences so you can know independent clause versus dependent clause, phrase versus clause, restrictive versus non-restrictive. So all of these things, it's much harder for parents to see than just that their kids are spelling walk, WOK. So that's the first reason that they never went back to teaching grammar. The second reason that they never went back to teaching grammar was that it's mere knowledge. Just like at the bottom of Bloom's taxonomy, it's mere knowledge that is the lowest order that is on there. And so we don't want to do that. We want to focus on the higher order teaching skills. That's what will get us kudos and pats on the back from these brilliant professors in college who will be so much more respectful of us if we don't focus on the lower order thinking skills. And the third reason is that they never went back to teaching grammar is right around this time, it became such a common thought that grammar in the traditional sense was really racist. Remember Ebonics? This was right around that time, and a lot of people were saying, well, speaking in a dialect is just as valid a choice as speaking in so-called proper English. Who are we to say what proper English is? And of course, it just happens that proper English is what white people use. No way. It's racist to teach grammar. Exclamation point, exclamation point, one exclamation point. So the teachers could not start teaching grammar again. If they did, they would be once again ostracized, cast out of the community. They would be really considered racist if they were teaching grammar again. And so, for all those reasons, teachers never went back to teaching grammar. And then, as things went on, as this continued for another 5 years, another 10 years into the aughts, a fourth reason came up. And this fourth reason was that the teachers and the students and the parents all looked around and they looked at their English classes and they said, ooh, I kind of like not having to know grammar. This is easier. Grammar is kind of hard. Diagramming those sentences, that was kind of hard. And there was a definite right and definite wrong there. And all those different terms, restrictive, non-restrictive, getting the right independent clause versus dependent clause, figuring out prepositions and objects of prepositions, knowing transitive versus intransitive verbs. Those are kind of difficult things to do. Let's just read some stories. Stories are fun. And you know, that's what happened. There was some inertia that was developed here. People got used to this and they realized that they could keep going this way and that grammar would be a lot more work, frankly, than doing just reading and reading comprehension. So they stuck with it. And that's where we are today. So spelling has come back, vocabulary has come back a tiny bit, but we still don't have grammar. Now, reading comprehension. So what are they reading then? Reading comprehension is 90% of the curriculum. I'll get to how it shows up in the standardized test, but if you take one thing away from today's episode, what are your kids learning in English? It's reading comprehension. That's it. That's 90%. Maybe 85%, but it's 90%, I think, of what goes on. So then the question naturally comes up, what are they reading to focus on this reading comprehension? Tell you a story. Last year, at the start of the year, I had 10th graders coming in and 11th graders coming in for chemistry. And I happened to say one day something about my banned bookshelf, right? And I have this shelf in my classroom where I keep a lot of actually banned books because I got really, really, really tired of the library and the English teachers coming out every year and saying, "Ooh, it's banned book week. We have to celebrate the banned books. Here's Harry Potter. And here's The Invisible Man. And here is Where the Red Fern Grows." And they would list all these books, these completely innocuous books that no one had ever banned. Not really. Maybe there were some Christian schools that kept out Harry Potter because it, I don't know, supported the occult. Or maybe somebody argued against Judy Blume's Dini because of the masturbation scene or something like that. But these books that they're putting out there, nobody considers Harry Potter controversial. I guess maybe you could consider J.K. Rowling's gender statements on Twitter to be controversial. But Harry Potter, no way. It was ridiculous to call this a banned book. And so I have a banned bookshelf in my classroom where I actually put up books that have been banned or at least taken off the shelves in libraries. And I had up there Huckleberry Finn, because Huckleberry Finn really has been removed from a lot of English courses and a lot of libraries because, of course, certain racial slurs that it uses. And I would argue also certain characters that it presents. So I mentioned that, and I said, I've got Mark Twain over there on my banned bookshelf now because this has happened. I was not expecting the response, which was, "Who?" Yeah, that's right. Some of the 11th graders did know it, but last year, my 10th graders, to a man, to a person, they did not know who Mark Twain was. First time that had happened in my career. They did not know who Mark Twain was. So then I did a little bit of a surreptitious follow-up. I didn't really want my students to feel bad about not knowing Mark Twain. So we went over who Mark Twain was, of course. And I mentioned how gobsmacked I was because it's important to know Mark Twain. He is in the canon, or at least he should be. So I did a little follow-up just to check. And if you're interested, Shakespeare, they did know who Shakespeare was, but they were 50-50 on whether or not Shakespeare lived before or after the American Civil War. I didn't even get into the Restoration and Cromwell and all that. I think that would have been quite less than 50-50, speaking of civil wars. But then they did not know Chaucer, did not know Browning, did not know Keats or Yeats or Faulkner. They didn't know that. They certainly didn't know that the novel, actually, here's what most of them put down for their timeline. They had the novel and the dramatic play and the epic poem all being invented about the same time. So they really are not learning Mark Twain and a history of language, a history of fiction. Now, the question comes up, if they're not learning Mark Twain, what are they learning? Let's use the 2021 June New York State Regents Exam in English as our guide. We open it up. We see first it starts off with, of course, a reading comprehension passage. There are a dozen or so questions about this passage here. And then after those dozen or so questions, it comes up with, yes, you guessed it, another reading comprehension package. Passage. And the second passage on the June 2021 English Regents exam in New York State is quite interesting because of who wrote it. And if you look up who wrote it, you will see it is written by the son of Mao's physician. That's right, Mao Zedong, the communist leader, the founder of communist China, his personal physician, actually left China and after he had worked with Mao, of course. And he was in Indonesia, I think, for a while. His son grew up in Indonesia, I think, until he was about five. This is Lee Young Lee we're talking about. And then they came to America. And so, yes, the second passage was written by Mao's doctor's son. Fascinating. Just delightful, isn't it? And then after that, the next set of questions is, you guessed it, another reading comprehension passage. And more questions about reading comprehension. Then there is an essay portion with an assigned topic. And another essay with an open topic. So, that's it. There is nothing else there. Now, after we look at that, we can see it's all just reading comprehension. Yes, there is writing, but I am sorry to tell you this. The writing skills that the kids are learning are not strong. In fact, when I say reading comprehension is 90% of the curriculum, I mean it. I mean it. The other 8% is writing and 2% just miscellaneous here and there. But the writing that they're learning is disorganized. It has the technical accomplishment of what you would consider in previous decades to be maybe, I don't know, the level of sixth grade, somewhere around there. They talk about parallel structure, for example, but that's it. As far as I can tell, they do not emphasize using a rich vocabulary. They can't do diction. They can't emphasize diction because in the old days, right, people used to talk about things like the difference between wish and desire and these fine distinctions between words that are very similar to this. The difference between a career and a job, right? The difference between fun and amusement. These sorts of fine distinctions between words are really important. And you have to find, when you're writing, you have to find just the right word to get your point across. Words are all you have when you're putting things down on paper. You have to find the right word. Mark Twain, right? Important to know Mark Twain. He said that the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. That's a pretty big difference. But we have lost that because we don't teach diction. We don't teach fine distinctions between words anymore. That's just mere knowledge. The vocabulary that we do, see this in 1 second more when we get to the standardized tests like the SAT, but the vocabulary that they do teach in English class is always in context. Again, that has to do with accusations of racism on standardized tests, and different kids are learning different words in different contexts, like bad. Michael Jackson changed the word meaning of the word bad, so maybe a kid thinks bad means good now. And because of that, you can only use vocabulary in context. Well, you can see that's a problem when you're writing, because when you're writing, you're responsible for both the context and the vocabulary. And if you don't know the vocabulary out of context, you can't put it into the right context when you're responsible for it yourself. So this idea of only doing vocabulary in context is completely failing our kids when it comes to writing. Their diction is almost non-existent. They're constantly choosing words that are not le mot juste, that are not the perfect word. They just throw words against the wall and let them see what sticks there. There is nothing like fine attention to detail. There is nothing like the fine, exquisite craftsmanship that you would hope to see from someone who gets into high school. So I'm just going to list what's missing from their writing then, and what they do learn. First, what they do learn for writing, they do learn the five-paragraph essay. They do learn topic sentences and thesis statements. Once in a while, they still learn how to use a con argument and how to address that, and then how to overcome that and use that to strengthen your own argument. The list of what they are not learning, of course. Oh, and they do learn parallel structure. They absolutely do learn that still. That is a darling, in fact, of the English curriculum. But the list of what they don't learn is longer. Just pick up any book on rhetoric, and pretty much everything in there except for parallel structure, they do not learn. For example, fine distinction and diction, like I said, etymology and etymological puns. This is far beyond them. You will see students writing things like, I arrived in the middle of the ocean. Of course, arrive comes from the Latin ad ripa, which means to the shore. Now, that's pretty advanced, but you would like to see it in an AP course, and you never see anything like that. Even more basic things like periodic sentences, loose sentences, making sure that your subject and your verb are as close together as possible for clarity, avoiding misplaced modifiers, dangling participles, using five sentences with appropriate concrete vocabulary. Just read, for example, Steven Pinker's Sense of Style. Most of the things that are in there are not being learned in the 8% or so of the curriculum that is actually useful writing instruction. And also note that as English has become easier, most kids think of English as way, way easier than math and science. Doesn't have to be, right? Does not have to be. You can make English pretty hard. But as English has become easier, a lot of states have counted on these in English classes to be something that kids will pass. And there's no way they're going to let a kid fail and not graduate. So the states count on kids passing the English exams. And they, in fact, in New York State, right around 2003, 2004, there was a new law passed that made it a requirement for kids to pass the Regents exam before they graduated high school. Before that, there were two different types of diplomas, local diploma and a Regents diploma, and it allowed the Regents exam to actually be kind of difficult in some cases. But since they required the Regents exams before graduating high school, well, guess what? The kids did not magically become smarter. What happened was they made the Regents exams much easier. And they've been running with that ever since. They dumbed everything down because they passed a law that said the kids have to pass before they could graduate. And they cannot have kids not graduate, right? I mean, that would affect their funding. That would maybe make them a focus school, and the state would swoop in and they would lose their power over their district. So the administration and the school boards and the teachers, they cannot have kids not pass. So they're happy to have really easy English classes, English tests. For example, you need 31 raw score out of 56 raw score. And a lot of this is subjective on the New York State English Regents exam to pass. 31 points out of 56 points. And it's very subjective in grading the writing and things like that. So it's pretty easy to pass. Now, we are running up against time here, but I did want to mention the ACT and the SAT. These are slightly better, as you would expect. The main reason that the SAT and the ACT are better than most state-level English curriculum is that they include usage. They don't call it grammar because they would be accused of being racist and being insensitive to people who grew up with different rules of grammar than they are applying. But they do still have usage questions. They look the same as the other questions. If you look at the SAT and the ACT now, most of it, there's the traditional reading comprehension where you read the passage and then you answer the questions on it. But a lot of it are these side-by-side two-column format questions where you have the reading passage on one column and side-by-side with it, the questions on the other side of the page. And sometimes those questions will say in lines 14 to 16, which is a better way to express this thought? And it will give you four options and then option E will be do not change it at all. It's better than the proposed option. And sometimes those options will depend on grammar, traditional grammar, but usually it's something like subject verb agreement, and sometimes it's a pronoun, and you have to identify the pronouns antecedent to make it work. So they do get in some usage and some sort of traditional grammar there. It's still not huge. It's still nothing like it used to be. And it's still not vocabulary out of context. But it is better than a lot of the state tests. And I'll also mention that on the AP reading list, it's really interesting to look at, right? They don't have an official reading list. But PrepScholar.com has a list where they've compiled all the books that have appeared at least twice since 2003 on the AP for English literature. And it is very telling. Since they have it broken up by time periods. And since 1970, you know, it's clear that identity politics are ruling the day. If you look back, of course, they do have Shakespeare on here 7 times, but they only have about 10 books from before 1800. Then they have 1800 books. Of course, Mark Twain is not on there, not a single time. Jane Austen makes it on there 3 times. Dickens makes it on there 5 or 6 times. But you also have people who don't write in English, of course. Dostoevsky, you have Tolstoy on there from the 1800s. And then once you start getting into the 1900s, and then it's pretty much what you'd expect. You would see J.D. Salinger's on there once. You start to see in the middle of the 20th century, you get James Baldwin, you get Ralph Ellison with Invisible Man. You get Richard Wright on there multiple times. You get Edward Albee on there. So Albert Camus makes it on there once, but there is no Sartre. And then once you get past 1970, everything changes. It's Anais and Cisneros, Wong. Toni Morrison makes it on there about 5 times. You have Leslie Marmon Silko, you have N. Scott Vomade. You don't have his poem Angle of Geese. It's just, these are just novels. You have Alice Walker, and you have Lahiri, you have Husseini. It's just very interesting that it's since 1970, the selection of writers is clearly dominated by some sort of eye towards identity politics. Well, that's the AP reading list. It's not official, as I say, but that's the list that Prep Scholar has compiled over the last 18, 20 years, since 2003. So to sum up, what's going on with English? What are your kids reading? Well, it's almost all reading comprehension. There are 5 points here. Number one, it's almost all reading comprehension. Talked about that. Number two, the writing that they do learn is almost completely devoid of fanciness, of flourish, of sophistication, of the devices of rhetoric that have been developed over the last couple of millennia. The writing that they do learn is basically to be sympathetic to their listener and to all causes, and also to pretty much put up a lot of words and try to make sure they're spelled right. They do teach spelling, which is fantastic. That is great these days. Next, the third point is that they don't always read English. A lot of the times it's translations that they're reading. That happens a lot. That's been going on for decades. I just have a little bit of cognitive dissonance there when it's called English class, but you're reading Marguerite Duras's Hiroshima Mon Amour, for example. Fourth point is that, as you can see from the AP's de facto reading list since 1970, it is determined in large part by identity politics and what group you belong to, rather than some other criteria. And the last point is that there is still a vestige of grammar on the AP and the SAT. And I have kids coming in all the time, all the time. I'm in the classroom and I am certified in English as well as chemistry and physics and math, but I've always taught in schools. I've always taught sciences because those are the most in demand. But even so, kids know that I'm proficient in English. And even though I teach science, I would always have kids coming into my room, showing me SAT prep questions, ACT prep questions, and asking, why is this wrong? Why is this right? When they get to the usage questions, they have no idea. They are not learning even the tiny morsels of grammar that are showing up on the SAT and the ACT. Two final ideas to leave you with, sorry. Number one is help your kids get into foreign language classes, because that's where they are still learning grammar, is in foreign language classes. You got to learn to conjugate. The foreign language often depends on things like direct objects and subjects and verbs. You have to learn it there. So get your kids in foreign language. That's where they will learn grammar more than in English class these days. And of course, keep in mind that the specifics of what they do in English class and what they learn in English class will depend a great deal on what books they are reading, because a lot of English class is just discussing, talking about the books that they are reading. So the individual book will determine a lot of what happens in English class. All right, guys, so that is today's What You Are Learning in English Class by request. Make sure that you check out the other piece of the podcast today. I'm putting up in a separate file because people said it was more convenient for them to have it in a separate file, where we talk about the top five dumbest pop culture moments of the week. I will see you soon. Take care.